So I'm going to talk, we're going to jump ahead now from the Buddha's time to the 7th and 8th century. So we're going to be jumping ahead 1,000 years to China. And this is more in southern, what would now be southern China. And this is the Tang Dynasty. So Buddhism has been established in China for some centuries now, and there have been different things going on, and certain schools ascend, and then another emperor who's not so favorably disposed to a particular sect or to Buddhism generally comes into power. So there's change, and although Buddhism flourished through the Tang Dynasty, we're getting near the end of the Tang Dynasty, and there's a much more political unrest and tension and uncertainty about what's going to happen into the future. So Huineng is a pretty remarkable man. The only person for whom there is a sutra other than the Buddha. So I'm going to be talking about the one thing that is a composition of the writings of Huineng and about his life, and it's called the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, and also the last patriarch who is Huineng. Huineng is the sixth Patriarch of China, Grand Master of Chan, who was a remarkable teacher, very powerful teacher, had many students that spread not only all over China, but their descendants spread into Japan. And he introduced not a new teaching, but reiterated some other teachings. And all his teachings are closely associated with the perfection of wisdom teachings of the Mahayana, and especially with the Diamond Cutter Sutra. He's inextricably linked with the Diamond Cutter Sutra, or the Diamond Sutra. So I have three different versions of the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, or the Sutra of Huineng, as it's sometimes called. They're different translations, but they're all basically the same. There's a first section where he's giving a talk in this on a religious platform to a large audience, which is why it's called the Platform Sutra. He starts by giving his own autobiography. Then he gives some sermons, which are the heart of his teaching, and then concludes. And then in these, there's another section at the end which talks about his life and his the teachings after his death, which I'm not going to go into today, but he had, after his death, there are all these remarkable events that happened for his disciples around his body and his remains and then his teachings. So I'm going to quickly go over his autobiography and then the essence of his teaching and read you a little bit of it. He's a good speaker himself, so I'll just give you some samples for that. Now, Huineng is a biological person. He really lived. He lived at this time. But this is embroidered with all kinds of other things. So even his autobiography in all these editions includes a great deal of, I guess what you'd call legend and other historical things that have been embroidered into his life. But he was a historical person, a historical person of great importance in the development of Buddhism in Asia, in China, Japan, Korea. And he gave a teaching really that is important for all times and all people. So his father was a civil servant who lost his job, was removed from office, which sent the family into poverty. They moved out into the frontier regions, and his father died when Huineng was still a boy. So he had responsibility for his mother, and he made a living chopping firewood and selling it. And it was a meager living, but that's what he did. He was 34 years old. He delivered some wood to a customer, and after leaving the wood for the customer, as he was leaving, he heard someone reciting the Diamond Sutra. And it instantly was like a bolt of electricity through him. And he stopped in his tracks, realized that he had to learn what this sutra was. He was illiterate. So he talked to the person who was reciting it, learned a little bit about it, instantly made a decision to get as much money as he could, set his mother up, and go study this, learn more about this. So he did that. He cut wood like crazy, did everything he could do, set up his mother as well as he could, and left. And made his way to the fifth patriarch, who's at that time, his name was Hung Jen, was a great teacher, and said, you know, I'm here I am, I want to learn more about the Diamond Sutra and about the teachings of the Buddha. And this is his introduction to Hung Jen. And Hung Jen said, "You're a barbarian from the south, from the southern frontier." And he said, "So what? The Buddha's teaching is irrespective of who you are as a person, where you come from, what your class is, what color your eyes are. I'm interested in the Buddha's teaching." So already Hung Jen knew this was a different kind of person. The monastery setting is basically focused on meditation and sutra study and repetition. So Weineng was sent to the off to chop wood and pound rice. So for 8 months he just worked in the kitchen, didn't, you know, wasn't part of the study, wasn't part of the other activities, except he worked in the monastery. Basically was quiet. Nobody asked him a lot of questions. Nobody bothered with him much. There's this legendary poetry contest. So Hung Jen is getting older and is thinking about passing on the robe and bowl, which is the transmission of the lineage to the next person. So he tells all his students, "Whoever can put into a verse their understanding of what I have taught, to that person will go the robe and bowl." His outstanding star student writes a poem. I'm not going to go into all the details of this now, but writes a poem. Huineng hears someone reciting that poem and thinks, "Oh, I don't think that's quite got it. That poem is sort of missing some of the point." So he goes to where the poem is written and says, "Can you, you know, translate this for me? I can't read." And they translate it. And he says, "Well, I would like to write a poem. Can you write another poem next to that?" And this is a government official who happened to be visiting. Says, "Well, you mean you can't write?" "No, I can't write, but I have a poem to put in response to this. So can you just write it next to him?" So he writes it. And everyone that comes by the poem is struck dumb, dumbfounded by the poem, because it penetrates right to the heart of understanding. You can read the two poems. They're very interesting. They're short little verses. So when Hung Jen sees the poem, he realizes this is the person who is going to be the next patriarch. But he can't just designate him, because there's so much rivalry and jealousy that it would be dangerous for him to do that. Everyone covets the bowl and robe and wants to be the next patriarch. And this person has been in the kitchen pounding rice and cutting firewood. What would this mean for the monastery? So he goes into the kitchen and says, "Is the rice ready?" And Huineng says, "It's been ready for a long time." And Hung Jen pounds his stick that he always carries three times on the floor. So instantly, Huineng knows that means in the third watch, I need to go to this teacher's room. He goes, it's the middle of the night. They discuss the Diamond Sutra. He passes on the bowl and robe and says, "Now you've got to get out of here." And Huineng says, "Where am I going to go?" He says, "Well, I'm going to start you off." So they head out, go to the river. He rows him across the river in the boat and says, "Go here, go there, you know, you're on your own. Don't forget to live by the Dharma, teach the Dharma. You're a gifted person. I'm gonna go back now." He goes back the next day, tells all his students what's happened. Everybody's in an uproar. They take off after Huineng. Huineng heads to the out into the wilderness and actually lives between 5 and 8 years with hunters in the wilderness. He cooks for them and helps them because he knows he had a few encounters with people who are following him and realized that his life is in danger. So, I mean, we're talking about years. So he's in his early 40s now. He has the robe and bowl, though, and these magical things have happened with people who've tried to take the bowl and robe and found they were unable to do it. But anyway, he begins to do a little bit of teaching, and apparently the political climate has quieted a little bit. So he finds his way to a monastery that some people suggest he go to because they realize he's a gifted teacher. There's this episode where a pennant is blowing in the wind, and these two monks are having a discussion about, is the flag moving? No, it's not the flag, it's the wind that's moving. And he hears their discussion, and he said, it's not the flag, it's not the wind, it's your mind. The motion is in your mind. And they, again, they're sort of dumbstruck at his insight into this. So he goes to the monastery. The abbot of the monastery realizes he's a gifted person. He starts to do a little teaching. He does more teaching. He gets fully anointed and shaved and made into a full-fledged monk. He produces the bowl and robe, and he teaches thousands and thousands of people, and dies at the age of 79 with students spreading out everywhere. So that's the story of Huineng. So what is it that he taught that gripped people so deeply and impressed them so thoroughly? And how many people here have any familiarity with the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Diamond Sutra? So it's a very profound teaching. It's kind of cuts through everything, and it's drawn straight from the Buddha's teaching. It's about the fact that nothing has a self-originating nature, that everything is interconnected, but interconnected at a level of beyond particular identities and the appearances of things. So, having said that, I'm just going to say a couple of things and then read you some of Huineng and see what you think. He uses an expression which is translated into essence of mind. So it's important to understand what the essence of mind is. It's an interesting expression, don't you think? I mean, it's sort of a strange expression in a way. But when you think about what essence is, you'll understand why it's used in this way. So essence means the inward nature of anything underlying its manifestations. So the inward nature of anything underlying its manifestations. So things have multiple, like, little manifestations, but there's something deeper underneath that. Or here's another definition. That which makes something what it is, intrinsic fundamental nature, or most important quality. And another definition, the permanent as opposed to the accidental element of being or consciousness. So if we were to take this podium and think of a podium, now there are lots of kinds of podiums. They have all different kinds of manifestations, but they're still podiums. So there's an essence of podium that underlies any particular podium. So the same is true of mind. You each have a particular mind, which has its own manifestation, and it actually changes. Your mind changes all the time in you. But underlying each of your mind, just like underlying this podium, there is an essence of podiums. There's an essence of minds. You could do it with anything. I mean, there's dogs have thousands of forms and shapes and personalities and dog minds, I guess. But underneath all, I mean, when we say dog, there's an essence of dogness, right? So there's an essence of mind that is larger than any particular mind, deeper and broader than any particular manifestation of mind, but there is a sort of ultimate mindness, which is the essence of mind. And Weineng's focus was on understanding this essence of mind because it's pure. It's intrinsically pure. It's not defiled by all the things that a particular manifestation of mind begins to get defiled by. There's a purity of mindness, which if we could connect back to and let that affect how we live, we could move beyond our all the particular aspects that tend to confuse us, lead us to be hateful, greedy, ignorant. So the focus of this is on understanding our true nature and living from the heart of that true nature. So when I read about essence of mind, this is about the essence of who you are, your essential being, your sort of permanent quality of your mind, if you want to think of it that way, as opposed to the temporary transient mind that happens to be associated with your particular body today and in this lifetime. This is an essence of mind is something that underlies all minds of all times, all consciousnesses of all times. And it's also slightly different language, but it's the same message as the Diamond Sutra, that this emptiness of the Diamond Sutra has a purity and clarity that if we could get to would be a source, an inspiration, and a wellspring for how we could live our lives in a way that would also have that kind of purity and clarity to it. Okay, so here's a few grapes I'll pick from Huineng's vine. It's nice, I'm going to refer to you as he refers to his audience as he's giving this kind of sermon, you could say, or series of sermons really on this platform. So he refers to them as learned audience. So I'm going to refer to you as learned audience. Learned audience. The essence of mind is the most exalted, the supreme, and the foremost. It neither stays, nor goes, nor comes. By means of it, Buddhas of the present, the past, and the future generations attain Buddhahood. We should use this great wisdom to overcome the three poisonous elements, that's greed, hatred, and illusion. And then we will be turned into good conduct, samadhi, which is concentrated mind, concentration, and pranya, which is wisdom. So part of his great teaching, by the way, is that these are not three different things. These are all interrelated. They're all kind of manifestations of this essence of mind, different angles of looking at it or different reflections of it. And his one great metaphor for the connection is between meditation and wisdom is that you can't have one without the other. They don't happen in a temporal way, like you learn to meditate and then you'll become wise. It's that there's one essence of mind. Realizing it, your behavior automatically becomes ethical. And wisdom and meditation have a relationship with each other as a lamp does to light. So if light is wisdom, meditation is a lamp, the purpose of a lamp, it wouldn't make sense to have a lamp except that you would want light. And you can't have light without some instrument that gets you there. But, I mean, you wouldn't want to just build a lamp, right? You would build a lamp because you wanted light. And you couldn't have light without having some means of generating light. Okay. When one is free from defilements, wisdom reveals itself and will not be separated from the essence of mind. Those who understand this will be free from idle thoughts. To be free from one particular thought, from clinging to desire, from falsehood, to put one's own essence into operation, to use pranya or wisdom for contemplation, to take an attitude of neither indifference nor attachment to all things. That is what is meant by realizing one's own essence of mind for the attainment of Buddhahood. So he's talking about, I'll just read it again, an attitude of neither indifference nor attachment. So we're not talking about indifference, I don't care. We're not talking about attachment, I want. The freedom is from both indifference, so you feel a passion about things, but without an attachment. Learned audience, without enlightenment, there would be no difference between a Buddha and other living beings. A gleam of enlightenment is enough to make any living being the equal of a Buddha. Our essence of mind is intrinsically pure, and if we knew our mind and realized what our nature is, all of us would attain Buddhahood. As the Diamond Sutra says, at once they become enlightened and regain their own mind. So he's telling people, you can get to a place of clarity and purity and fearlessness if you focus yourself on having that be your goal and become, as he puts it, thoughtless. You need to let go of thought. Thought is what obscures your perfectly clear, radiant mind. So wisdom, in his view, is the same as this kind of thoughtlessness. It's not thoughtlessness as an opposite to mindfulness. It's thoughtlessness letting go of thinking, the busy mind that is always thinking, making up stories about who we are, making up stories about the world, believing those stories to be true, acting as if they were true. It's clearing away all that activity of the mind to come to back to that place of purity and clarity. Thoughtlessness is to see and to know all things with a mind free from attachment. When in use, it pervades everywhere, and yet it sticks nowhere. What we have to do is to purify our mind so that our senses, the objects that come through our senses, will neither be defiled nor attached. When our mind works freely without any hindrance and is at liberty to come or go, we attain concentration, wisdom, and liberation. Such a state is called thoughtlessness. And for him, it happens moment to moment. It isn't like you work hard, you get it by degrees, and you accomplish it. It's a kind of clarity that you come to, and once you come to it, everything sort of feels and has a different quality to it. So you learn how to clear away these thoughts, and you can just relate back to it. So every moment you relate back to it, you become a Buddha. You become pure and clear. But you have to keep doing it. And I think this is consistent with the Buddha's teaching also. It isn't like you attain enlightenment and it's a state and you're there forever. His focus, and I think the Buddha's, is that enlightenment is actually an activity. Enlightenment arises out of you and what you're doing at the moment. It depends on a moment of clarity. If what you're doing is just concentrating, that's a moment of enlightenment. If you string enough of these moments together, I mean, the Buddha never stopped meditating, never stopped acting out of enlightenment. It's enlightened activity. Enlightenment isn't just like a state of consciousness that you arrive at, and once you arrive there, you have it, and there's no going back, and you can just relax. It's like a beautiful, joyful clarity that you just want to hold on to. So you keep refreshing your mind back to that clear, pure, radiant place. I'll just read you one more thing. To keep our mind free from defilement under all circumstances is called idealessness or thoughtlessness. Our mind should stand aloof from circumstances, and so on no account should we allow our mind to be influenced by what is going on around us. It is a great mistake to suppress our mind from all thinking, for even if we succeed in getting rid of all thoughts and die immediately thereafter, still we shall be reincarnated elsewhere. The idea is not to push away your thoughts, but to allow your thoughts to come and go, not hold on to them, not stick to them. So he's actually, and much of the later part of this, is writing kind of vehemently against the idea of meditating, sitting and becoming a bag of rice, as he calls it. I mean, you eat and sit. It's enlightened activity. Or at another point he calls monks hangers for robes. Like they just... if you're not living a life out of your clarity and purity, what is the good of it? And this is a reaction to those monasteries, which were also very popular at the time, where people just went and sat and did something like zazen for days and weeks, and that's all they did. Mark this, treaders of the path. It is bad enough for a man to commit blunders from not knowing the meaning of the law, but how much worse would it be to encourage others to follow suit? Being deluded, he blasphemes the Buddhist canon as well as the civil law. Therefore, we take idealistness as our object. Let me explain more fully why we take idealistness as our object. It is because there is a type of person under delusion who boasts of the realization of essence of mind, but being carried away by circumstances, ideas rise in his mind, followed by erroneous views, which are the source of all sorts of false notions and defilements. In the essence of mind, which is the embodiment of the void, there is intrinsically nothing to be attained. To say that there is attainment and to talk thoughtlessly on merits or demerits are erroneous views and defilements. For this reason, we take idealistness as the object of our school. You have ideas, you have opinions, you have thoughts. They stick nowhere, they go everywhere, but you don't take them as if they were a truth. There's only one essential truth behind all the little things of our mind, and that is the pure, radiant clarity, this essence of mind, idealistness, thoughtlessness. All things, good or bad, beautiful or ugly, should be treated as void. Even in times of disputes and quarrels, we should treat our intimates and our enemies alike, and never think of retaliation. In the exercise of our thinking faculty, let the past be dead. If we allow our thoughts, past, present, and future, to link up in a series, we put ourselves under restraint. On the other hand, if we never let our mind attach to anything, we shall gain emancipation. For this reason, we take non-attachment as our fundamental privilege, principle. Well, I'll just stop there, but I think you get the idea. I hope you get the idea. The idea is idealessness. The idea is finding your essence of mind. So that's Green Egg.